the very beginning of this morning's Torah portion reads as follows. Vayedaber Hashem el Moshe, God says to Moses, Bahar Sinai Lemor. God said this to Moses on the mountain of Sinai. Now, very few laws, ideas in the Torah are prefaced by explicitly stating that they were given at Sinai. So we prepare ourselves for something terribly important. This is what God said to Moses at Sinai, Ten Commandments. Or this is what God said to Moses at Sinai, V'ahavta l'reicha kamocha, love your neighbor as yourself. Some grand moral principle. But that's not what follows. What follows is the laws of Shemitah. Shemitah is the sabbatical year. Every 7 years, you should let the land lie fallow, and then every 50 years there is a jubilee. The rotation of crops is what they're talking about. And so incongruous is this juxtaposition, is the fact that one is next to the other. It is so strange that even in modern Hebrew, there is an expression, Ma inyan shmita etzel har Sinai. What is the point of talking about the sabbatical next to Mount Sinai? It is a way of saying what you just said has nothing to do with what you said before. I remember when I first went to Israel as a child in a trip from my father's congregation in Philadelphia, that there I went with all these grand dreams about what it was going to be Mount Sinai. I was going to see the land of Israel, and I cannot tell you how many hours on the bus I spent listening to drip irrigation. Those of you who have traveled to Israel know, less true now than it used to be, that Israel created and introduced drip irrigation to the world. I'm sure it's a wonderful thing. I like kumquats as much as the next guy. But I have to tell you, I didn't travel across the world to listen to drip irrigation. And had I been given the idiom, I would have said, Ma'inyan Shemitah Eitzel Har Sinai. What's the point of talking about the sabbatical laws and specifying them in particular as having come from Mount Sinai? As you can imagine, the rabbis jump in with explanations, and I have a few for you. Should never be satisfied with just one explanation. It means people aren't thinking hard enough. The classical explanation, which is the one that Rashi gives, is that just as all the particulars of the laws of the sabbatical and the jubilee are given at Sinai, because the portion, the Torah, goes on to give very specific laws about how the sabbatical is to be observed, just as that is given in particular, so all the particulars of all the other laws were given at Sinai. In other words, this is the Torah's way of saying, don't think that insignificant laws don't have a connection to Sinai. They all do, every one of them. But of course, even if you like that explanation, it does not satisfy the question of why in particular the sabbatical. You could have given the particulars of any law you want and made the same point, which is that the particulars of the law come from Sinai. Why the sabbatical? Or HaChaim, who is a Moroccan, often mystically inclined commentator, said, the idea is to tie together the acceptance of the Torah and the inheritance of the land. In other words, if you accept what happened at Sinai, then you deserve to enter the land. And so you should know that the land, too, comes from Sinai. A modern commentator, Yeshayahu Leibovitz, has a very nice explanation, which doesn't contradict, of course, what Or HaChaim said, but supplements it. He says, what is the sabbatical year about? It's about social relations. It's about every 50 years the land returns to its owner. I have to let my land lie fallow. So do you. We're all farmers in agriculture. It's creation of community. And he says the point here is that social relations, too, have something to do with God. That the structure of society has something to do with God. That we shouldn't think that only prayer, sacrifices, divine things are divine, and human things have nothing to do with God. Those realms are not separate. And then finally, for those of you who like modern scholarship and investigation of other societies around Israel at the time, I have one for you too, which is that it is an ancient Mesopotamian practice. And as you may know, this is a practice that continued throughout human history, that when a king would assume his throne, he would issue a general release of slaves. Manumission followed a king taking his throne in a similar way now, as we know that when a president leaves, what's one of the last acts he commits in office? He pardons people, both pardonable and sometimes not so much. And similarly here, God, in assuming the kingship of Israel at Sinai, is announcing the laws of release of the land and the fact that they are no longer slaves. They were slaves to Egypt, but now they are no longer slaves, and in fact they will have their own land, be able to work it, and be free men and women. So those are all the possibilities that I came up with, at least in a little bit of checking through some traditional commentaries, but I think that all of them point to something that he's both larger and also more immediately relevant to us as we look at this parsha, and especially for those of you who joined us, for those of us who just returned from the land of Israel. Because, as you know, for thousands of years, the land of Israel was a dream that had no responsibility. You know that beautiful title of a wonderful short story by the poet Delmore Schwartz in Dreams Begin Responsibilities? Well, this for us was a dream without responsibilities. Israel and Jerusalem could, in Jewish legend, be described any way you want. There is a book that I have by Raphael Patai called Legends of Jerusalem, and the Jerusalem in that book is the Jerusalem the way it was imagined by our ancestors. A perfect place, a wonderful place, a heavenly Jerusalem, not encumbered by any of the difficulties and the pains and the strife of a real world city in a difficult neighborhood. And then all of a sudden, the dream is realized. And you go back to Jerusalem as it is, and you discover, as you travel not just through Jerusalem, but through the land of Israel, that while it is very much about the accumulation of legend and dream and hope, it also has a lot to do with drip irrigation. That in fact, crops don't grow on legends, and people can't eat dreams. We went back to Jerusalem, where my wife had lived about 15 years ago, before I met her and deprived Israel of an upstanding citizen. And from her year in Jerusalem, as she was walking around, what was one of the first things that she remembered? Where the laundry was. She said, I'm sure if we walk around this corner and go here, this was where I did my laundry. And we walked around, and it was the same guy, by the way, from 15 years ago. So should you be in Jerusalem and need a reliable guy who's going to be there? I know just the guy. And we realized that that landmark had become for us part of Jerusalem. Because it represented the fact that she had lived there every day. That it wasn't just a dream, and it wasn't just a fantasy, and it wasn't just Mount Sinai, it was also the Shemitah, the sabbatical. It was the attachment to the land, the necessity of living day to day. And we have a tendency to separate, as is natural, that day-to-day living from the exalted part of the tradition. If I say to you it was exciting in Jerusalem to see where we could do our laundry, it sounds not, I don't want to say not logical, but it doesn't fit. It doesn't sit well. You shouldn't be worried about laundry in Jerusalem. You can be worried about laundry in Los Angeles, but Jerusalem, you should be worried about prayer. But that is the inyan of Shemitah Etzel Har Sinai. We drove on the bus, and we're riding along, sleepy, as is the perpetual condition of tourists in Israel. And the guide says, out your right window is the Intel building, and you know that Israel has a greater per capita, has greater number of software startups per capita than any country in the world. And we look, and there's the Intel building, and everybody nods and smiles. And he says, and by the way, on your left is the plain where David fought Goliath. And although I can't say that through my bleariness I thought of it at the time, he could just as easily have said, Ma'inyan Shemitah Etzel Har Sinai. What's the Intel building doing next to the plain where the Philistines were defeated? But of course, that's the whole point of the land of Israel, is that it shouldn't only be a dream, is that it should be a place where people build software countries and do their laundry and raise their children and argue about schools and do all the things that Israelis do. And it is moving, and it is beautiful to climb Masada and know that you stand where the last self-governing Jews stood 2,000 years ago. It is a very powerful moment. But guess what? No one lives on Masada. Masada is a place where you go, you learn, you are inspired, and you leave. I checked. No laundromats on Masada. And you cannot live without Shemitah, without the day-to-day and year-to-year, and God willing, century-to-century stuff of daily life. That's what makes going to Israel so exhilarating and so difficult. Because, of course, each morning you open the paper and you are reminded that this is not only a place of spirit. It is a place of strife and politics and questions and arguments. I went to hear Amos Oz, who spoke here a few years ago. He was giving a lecture on behalf of the Israel Museum, and we sat there, and the first thing he said was, you have to listen to me because I represent history. He said, I know that that may seem like a bold claim, but realize that I can say something that no American can say, which is, I knew personally everybody who is on Israel's currency. And when he said that, you realize anew, this is actually still a very young state. Right? But then he went on to say, when people ask me to define Israel, what is Israel? Is it a state? Is it a community? Is it the Jewish tradition? Is it a new definition? He says, I like to think of Israel as a collection of arguments. And in fact, you can debate your way on issues big and small through the land, and you realize anew, Ma'inyan Shemitah Etzel Har Sinai, the whole point of going to a modern state is that a modern state is where people live, not just where they dream, not just where they pray, not just the place towards which we orient ourselves, but where they live. The streets of Israel are calm these days, calmer than they have been in years since, at least judging by the previous visits that I have made and many of you have made. But the reality of life there has not disappeared, and what is called the matzav, the situation, still weighs on everyone's mind. We were there during Yom HaZikaron, Memorial Day for the fallen soldiers of Israel, and we went to a ceremony at the Kotel, at the Western Wall. And what was most striking about it was to see how many young people, and when I say young people, I mean young. Don't forget, Israeli soldiers are young, 18 years old. They're barely out of high school. How many young people gathered around in one place to listen to the speeches, to say the prayers, to remember their friends. It was a powerful and a painful moment. And you realize, we may think of Israel in very hazy, exalted, and legendary terms, but it is in fact a place where people live and where they die. If you have to think about what kind of attitude to take towards Israel and towards its future, I think that the best attitude to take is the attitude taken by Viktor Frankl in his book Man's Search for Meaning, a book that I actually read in the course of our trip in Israel because I'm writing an article. The Jewish Journal asks rabbis to contribute an article about a book that everyone should read, and I took Man's Search for Meaning. And in it, Frankl says that the healthiest attitude towards life is an attitude of tragic optimism. Tragic optimism because the truth is you don't want to be somebody who walks through life blind to the difficulties and the pains and the tragedies of your own life and of others. That isn't optimism, that's callousness, verging on inhumanity. You can't walk through the streets of Israel where so many have lost so much and say, everything's going to be fine. For too many people, everything will never be fine. But at the same time, you cannot escape the reality that however you define the word, you are walking through the modern embodiment of a miracle. I mean, let's return to Masada a moment ago. Thousands of years ago, Jews lost sovereignty over this land. They lost their last opportunity to govern themselves, to fight for themselves, to create a community with an organic structure and language. It was gone. And suddenly, thousands of years later, it was reborn. We were there also on Yom HaAtzmaut, on Independence Day. And I remembered on Independence Day those Zionist thinkers that I had studied, Herzl, Berdichevsky, Achat HaAm, and someone who is not much remembered today, Pinsker, who wrote a book called Auto-Emancipation. And in that book he said, here is the problem with the Jewish people before they have a state. They are a soul without a body. And to be a soul is in some ways a beautiful thing, because it is a kind of pure, unsullied religiosity, a pure faith that burns within you, but you cannot actually exist in this world just as a soul. Pinsker wrote this before the Holocaust. And as everybody knows, having a body is a messy and difficult and painful thing. Bodies break down. Bodies give you pain. Bodies betray. But it is much better to have a body. The same thing with modern Israel. Are there things about it that will anger, annoy, sadden, and hurt you? Absolutely. Is it a perfect place? Certainly not. But it's real. It's where they grow fruit as well as pray to God. We ended our trip, about which I hope to speak more in the coming weeks, with the ceremony of receiving the Torah. We went there to give a Torah and to receive a Torah. Both, by the way, wonderful things to do. And also, if you have not had the experience of, as I now have, of walking through an airport with a Torah in your duffel bag, I recommend it highly. I was just waiting for somebody to say to me, "What do you have in the bag?" And nobody did. So, but when we received the Torah, I talked about the fact that Shavuot, which is the holiday on which we will read from that Torah the first time, Shavuot is a holiday with no real solid commemoration. On Passover, you have a Seder. On Sukkot, you have a Sukkah. On Shavuot, nothing. Some people eat blintzes. It's not really, you know, a sukkah, a blintz, it's not really. But why is that? Why is it that this holiday in which we celebrate receiving the Torah has no concrete symbol that draws us to the holiday? Let me close by offering you one answer. The Passover celebrates something that was. You're supposed to feel as if you were in Egypt, but you're not in Egypt. Sukkot celebrates something that was. You're supposed to feel as if you were wandering and traveling through the desert, but you're not wandering and traveling through the desert. Shavuot celebrates what is. At every moment, we're supposed to receive the Torah, which means we are supposed to embody the word. At Har Sinai, we have to learn the laws of Shemitah. At a moment of exalted religious meaning, we have to learn how to translate it into our lives and into our land. That's the struggle that you see in the land of Israel. It is to take the ideals, sometimes disembodied, of thousands of years, and to actually live them in a place where living ideals is extraordinarily, horrifically difficult. You know that when they bring soldiers up to Masada and induct them into the Israeli armed forces, they get two things. They get a Torah, a Tanakh, and a gun. And they are told, the Tanakh is your birthright, the Bible is yours, the gun you must earn. In other words, it is by your conduct, by your discipline, by your self-control, by your judgment, that you will enact what is found in this book. It is a beautiful and an exhilarating experience to be in Israel. But it is not only beautiful because we stood at the wall, because we danced on Shabbat, because we received the Torah. It was also beautiful, and I mean this sincerely, because we did our laundry, because we ate our breakfast, because we saw the Intel building. In other words, it wasn't only the land of our imaginations. It was the land that we have walked into, that we inhabit, in which we live. And for all of its difficulties, for all of its pains and questions, it is a blessed land. And for those of you who didn't have the chance to travel with us on this trip, I hope in the coming year that you too will find out the Inyan Shemitah Etzel Har Sinai, why it is that at the most important religious moment in Jewish history, God says, this is how you treat the land. This is how it will grow fruits and vegetables for you. This is how you will feed your family. This is how you will serve me. This is how you should live. Shabbat Shalom.